Hey, this is Daphne. Welcome to the Creativity Habit Podcast, conversations about art, creativity, and courage with artists, creatives, and makers. My guest today is a writer and a woman of great strength, beauty, and genius. She lives inside the world of physical and mental illness, and then writes of that world with honesty, skill, and grace. Her essays have appeared in The Believer, Hazlitt, Lenny, Elle, Catapult, Eater, and Salon. And her debut novel, The Border of Paradise, was named one of NPR's best books of 2016. She also won the 2016 Grey Wolf Nonfiction Prize and is now working on a collection of essays about schizophrenia for Grey Wolf Press. And she runs an online resource with courses and writings for, quote, ambitious people with limitations. She is Esme Wang, and you can find her at esmewang.com. In this interview, we talk about how to deal with artistic jealousy, what it takes to persevere in the face of rejection after rejection, how to endure suffering, how much to share, and where do you draw the line? And how do you know your creative voice? May you enjoy this conversation, and may it inspire you to make your thing and change your world. Welcome, Esme, to the Creativity Habit. It is such an honor and pleasure to have you here. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Daphne.
I like to begin all my interviews by starting with your creativity story, which is really just taking us back to your childhood and sharing how creativity showed up for you as a child.
I remember being very small, so maybe 4 or 5, and filling notebooks with scribbles that I thought were writing. So if you go back to my parents' house and look in the garage, there are notebooks that are just these squiggles that are meant to look like penmanship, because that's kind of what I thought writing was at the time. I think from a very young age, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I started making books with my mother when I was a little bit older and able to actually write. We would sew these books together with hard covers and cloth binding and saddle stitching. And around that time, I really started becoming interested in what it meant to be a writer. I actually wrote to Little Brown and Company when I was 6 years old.
That's
and
great.
Asked them, how do I become a published writer?
Oh.
And they actually wrote back. I can still picture it in my mind, although I'm not sure where this letter is now. I kind of wish I still had it, but they sent me back this typed letter. The only thing I can remember from this letter is that they told me I needed a literary agent, which I wouldn't, which I wouldn't get for many more years. I wouldn't be actually the client of a literary agent for many more years, but that was a sign, I think, from a young age that I did want to be a writer. I don't think that there was ever a time when I didn't want to be a writer from then on, although there were definitely times when I thought it was impractical and so would take these little detours and study other things that I thought would allow me to make a living more easily.
So in those detours, like, what was your relationship to writing during those detours?
I was always still writing. I was never not writing during these detours, but I'm also the child of Taiwanese immigrants, and I think it's a common immigrant story in that my parents really wanted me to have something concrete, something like becoming a lawyer or a doctor, something that I could be sure that I'd be able to make money with. So for a while, I decided I might go into some form of neurology. I thought for a while I might be a doctor of some kind, maybe a psychiatrist. I worked as a lab manager at Stanford for about 3 or 4 years. And during that time, I was, you know, still writing. I was not as disciplined as I would later become, in part because I was of two minds about it. I really believed, as I had been told over and over again, that trying to become a writer as a living was not a good idea. And I would even say now that I wouldn't call my main income as being from writing. I think that's very misleading, especially for people who are looking to become writers. But I continued to write and continued to work every day at a lab. I thought I was going to go get my PhD in clinical psychology, and that went on for a while.
you feel like it's misleading to say that you make your living as a writer. What does that look like now? Like, what, how does writing show up in your life now? And what role does it play in your full-time job, quote unquote? I know you're an entrepreneur in your full-time work.
Yeah, that was that's an interesting question. I actually decided to dive a little bit deeper into this question by looking at my income from 2016. So I was a little bit surprised to see that my writing, whether that included freelance writing for publications or the book deal that I got last year, or money from my first novel, that was about the same amount of income as the amount I made as a small business owner of an online business. So it was about 50-50. I do consider the work I do at EsmeWang.com to be creative. It does involve making things, but it's not what I would call part of my quote unquote literary writer persona or manner of being.
I know you have your novel was recently published. Is that where you would consider yourself, like, that's your writing career, since you say that you don't really see EsmeWang.com as that?
Yeah, this is actually something that I'm struggling with a bit at this point. So EsmeWang.com is what I call a place that contains resources for ambitious people living with limitations. But it's also a site where you can go and find out about my literary work. You can go and find out about the novel I published last year. You can find out about the essay collection I'm working on right now for Grey Wolf Press. You can also find links to essays that I've published in all kinds of places, from Elle Magazine to Hazlitt to Lenny. So it's a place that kind of holds both of those things, but I'm having a bit of an identity crisis in terms of my quote-unquote career, or what I call my career.
You've written quite a lot about illnesses, and as you mentioned, the EsmeWang.com is for people with limitations, which to some degree we all have. You know, every human being has limitations. But you're talking, at least you've spoken a lot about mental illness, and I know you've engaged in several interviews about it, and you write about it extensively. So because there's a lot of information out there, I don't want that to be the focus of this interview. It's more about your writing and art and your creativity. But because it's such a fundamental part of who you are and of your work, can you briefly explain for people listening who aren't familiar with this part of who you are? Can you talk briefly about that?
Sure. So I started experiencing symptoms of serious mental illness when I was about 11. I've had a number of diagnoses since then, including clinical depression, bipolar disorder, and right now schizoaffective disorder, bipolar type. And that's a kind of what I call a mix of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. It's interesting because I started writing about illness when I decided to start writing about mental illness. But since about 2011 or 2012, physical illness and chronic physical illness has become much more of an issue in my life and is something that I'm dealing with every single day. So that is another aspect of illness that I have been introduced to. And so I feel fluent in both those worlds at this point.
One of the things that was so fascinating for me in really diving into your world is the grace with which you speak about both the physical and mental illness. There's such an absence of anger, or I don't even know the words for it, but I was really moved by how beautifully you speak about your path through mental illness and now physical illness. Do you try to cultivate that? Is that something that's natural for you?
Well, first of all, thank you so much. That's an amazingly kind thing to say, and quite a compliment. I would say it's a little bit of both. I do consciously try to cultivate that because I feel that getting through various kinds of illness, chronic illness, mental illness, trying to get through that while being full of anger and despair is not particularly helpful for me. And so cultivating that has been important for me. There are definitely times when I'm feeling, you know, despair kind of nipping at my heels, and I go online and write something that's almost an antidote to that on, for example, my Instagram feed, because I want to write the words that I want to hear. So that's one aspect of it. However, I do also feel that it comes somewhat naturally to me. I used to call myself an optimistic pessimist or a pessimistic optimist, but yeah, there's something in me that's very stubborn when it comes to wanting to keep going. There's something in me that does want to find the beauty and grace in very difficult times. So I think both of those things feed into that.
Yeah, and you have an eye for beauty as well. I mean, you were a fashion blogger and you always dressed beautifully in all your Instagram pictures. And so I imagine that that serves, you know, to be able to really perceive beauty in the way that you do in the world.
Yes, as I feel that aesthetics are incredibly important to me. My friends make fun of me because I think I do have over 100, maybe hundreds of desktop wallpapers saved to my computer. And that's because every morning when I wake up and I start working, I need to pick the right desktop wallpaper for that day.
Wow.
I have friends who have had the same desktop wallpaper for over a decade. Even if they switch computers, they have the same desktop wallpaper. But for me, the aesthetics of my surroundings, the aesthetics of my computer, the aesthetics of what I wear, all of that really matters to me. And so I'm most comfortable when I feel the aesthetics around me are beautiful, or if they match how I'm feeling or how I want to feel.
In a large sense, the aesthetics, they contribute to your creativity. I mean, they help foster your creativity.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, I could not. I feel like I almost could not work if I had some awful, ugly desktop wallpaper that I didn't choose. It sounds silly, but yeah, that's how I feel about it.
So I want to talk a little bit now about how writing plays into all of this, because in a post on writing on EsmeWang.com, you said, "I write to make sense of things for myself, to make a narrative of things that otherwise feel like socks tumbling in a drawer. I write because I see or hear or feel something that I want to be able to transmit to someone else. I write because I can't imagine not writing." So talk to me a little bit about how writing helps you make sense of things.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So there are so many ways in which other writers have said this with much more grace than I have. But there's something, I think is it Joan Didion who said,
yeah.
Joan Didion has many quotes about this. One of the more famous ones is, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live." But there is also other quotes from other writers. I'm not exactly sure who said, "I write to make sense of things," or something like that. There are many writers who have said things like this. And so I think one of the most interesting things for me about essay writing, so I do call myself an essayist and a novelist, because those I feel are my two main literary forms. Those are the two literary forms that I feel most comfortable with. And in terms of essays, I love diving into writing an essay not knowing where I'm going. So I might start with this question, like, okay, I want to write something about going to a Catholic pilgrimage. This is something I am working on, but I want to write something about going to a site of Catholic pilgrimage where people go in order to find healing. And I want to write about my own pilgrimage to that site. I also want to write something related to that in the same essay about the connection between mental illness and physical illness. I also want to write something to address something in that essay about hope and about despair. So I kind of go in with like all these things in my mind, and it's not until I'm writing the thing that I realize what I want to say, or I'm exploring my own mind and what I have been thinking about subconsciously that doesn't quite find eloquence until I do some writing and rewriting.
So when you have all these different places that you're coming at a piece, like an essay with, that doesn't leave you feeling somewhat like, oh my gosh, where do I begin? Like, do you just dive in and start with all of those different angles that you're considering?
Yeah, it really depends. So, with that particular essay, which I have not started yet, as I'm thinking about how I might start it, there are two ways that I have written essays. And so, one way is to just dive in and to just start and see where it goes. And if there are places where I need to do more research, or if, I need to refer to notes, I might go do that. But yeah, there is the possibility that I will start that essay by just diving in. The other way I've written essays, and this is how I wrote the Believer essay toward the pathology of the possessed, which was a notable essay in Best American Essays 2016. And I love that essay so much. It's going to be in my forthcoming essay collection. So that essay, there were so many moving parts to that one. It's about schizophrenia and the cultural idea of possession really as related to schizophrenia. So for that, I had this big stack of index cards. As I was doing research, I would make notes on these index cards from my own experience. As I was doing interviews with people, I would transcribe the interviews and then write down certain quotes on those cards. And then I would spread them out and try to organize an essay from the index cards. And so that's one way I also do things.
I know in an interview that you did with The Rumpus, you had written, "I cannot write by," or you'd said, "I cannot write by outlines. I like to wander around in the dark and see where things go." And that ends up meaning I go down a lot of paths that don't end up going anywhere. I was curious about that in some ways in terms of resilience, because a lot of times when we go down paths over and over again that don't go anywhere, we could say, "Ah, oh, this is frustrating. I just spent all this time and I ended up nowhere." So, how does that feel frustrating for you, or is it just feel like part of the process?
Yeah, so that quote from The Rumpus was actually more about fiction writing. And so, in terms of fiction, I don't think I could write from an outline. That feels really horrible to me and almost not worth doing. I would maybe rather not write a work on a novel or write a novel if I had to do it that way. So, I love the idea of writing novels the way I do as a kind of resilience, because it does take resilience to be a writer. You may have seen this in other interviews, but I actually did write over 200 pages of a completely separate novel that is never going to be published. I had written it over a number of years. One day I finally read The Sound and the Fury by Faulkner, and as soon as I finished reading it, I threw away the whole novel. I realized that I wanted to be more ambitious with my writing after I read that book. And so, in some ways, you could say, wow, what a waste of all those years and all that time you spent writing this hundreds of pages. And in a way, it was, nothing got saved from that novel. I'm never going to publish it. Not a single sentence from that work is going to appear in anything else I publish because I don't believe in it. It's not a work that I'm proud of. But I can also say that writing that novel taught me a lot about writing in the doing. And I carry that with me. It also reminds me of that saying that people have about, Olympic performers when they're actually at the games, been practicing for this few minutes your whole life. Yeah, I think all of it adds up, all of it accrues.
Your response to that is so interesting to me, because you read The Sound and the Fury, you said, "Forget it. Forget this whole thing I've been writing." And as you say, I want to be more ambitious with my writing. And what happens to a lot of people is you might read something and go, "Oh my gosh, I will never write as well as Faulkner. Forget it. Just forget it." And instead, you said, "No, I want to take my writing to the next level as a result of reading him." So, in exploring that a little, what do you think is the difference between the person who says, "There's no way I can ever be this good, so I'm just not even going to try," versus, "Oh my gosh, I just got shown a possibility, a potential that I can now move in the direction of"?
That's a really interesting question. And as you were asking it, my mind was kind of going in a number of different ways. But it also reminds me of this friend I had, and we went to the SF MoMA. I think we were at the Jasper Johns exhibit. This friend of mine was a painter. He saw all the paintings that we were around. I remember him being so upset, just so despairing. And I think he said something like, I'm never going to be able to paint this well, or something. He was just very upset. There was something about being around all those Jasper Johns paintings that made him feel like he could never be that good. And he was upset by it. And I've experienced this in talking with certain other types of artists, whether they're playwrights or novelists or, you know, filmmakers, is oftentimes the people that I encounter, when they encounter a work that they find really wonderful and really extraordinary, they become depressed and ask themselves, why bother? I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to do this. But there are also a group of people that I know who are incredibly invigorated by it. You know, that type of person, if they're a painter, might go to the Jasper Johns exhibit and be so inspired and say, oh my gosh, I want to go home and paint right now after seeing the exhibit. And as you were asking the question, I was also wondering, so what makes the difference between those people? And, you know, it might be an innate thing, or it might be related to how a person was raised. I really don't know. But it also reminds me of ways in which people can differ when it comes to resilience and illness. There's a line from Sarah Manguso's book. I think it's, I always get this title wrong. I think it's called The Two Kinds of Decay. But she's talking about this chronic illness, this very severe chronic illness that she was diagnosed with when she was relatively young. And she said something like, developing a severe chronic illness either causes you to become incredibly bitter and misanthropic, or it causes you to become more compassionate and loving toward the world and other people. I completely paraphrased that, and she put it much more beautifully than I just did. But that, it also reminds me of that. There are always different ways we can go, different choices that we can make.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it really does come down to choice, and it may be part of your personality that is like the pessimistic optimist, or that says, okay, this writing isn't good, it's not good enough, but there's the optimist part that says, but I can make it better.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And actually, when you talked about your friend looking at those paintings and feeling like, oh my gosh, I will never be able to paint like this, it reminded me of this post that you wrote about on artistic jealousy, where you talk about being part of different communities of writers. You said there's a competitiveness born of ambition. It's this combination of tenderness and pseudo-jealousy that has caused me some of the most painful, beautiful moments in my writing life. So again, there's the duality, the pain and the beauty. And I would love for you to speak to a little bit about what is the pain and what is the beauty that happens in artistic jealousy.
Yeah, I think the artistic jealousy is such a component of that conversation we were just having, in that sometimes jealousy is purely poisonous. There was a time in my life when I was extremely jealous of one friend who was a writer in particular, who has by now won like some of the biggest awards you can win in the literary world. But back then, we were all just starting, this group of friends, we were all just starting to become writers. And jealousy in that time, I think it was largely not helpful to me. It made me feel bad. I wasn't inspired by it. The older I got, the more I kind of grew out of that type of artistic jealousy, and the more being jealous caused me to see what I wanted out of my own writing. So it became much more of a motivator to become as good and actually better. I work to become better than the people I'm jealous of.
And for that person who's on the earlier end, like you were in the beginning, you say, when you were younger and also just starting out, so the combination of both in your case, but just wherever we're at, if we're in that place where it's more pain than beauty, more pain than encouragement, how do you suggest meeting the jealousy in a way that we can move, keep going in the face of it?
Yeah, I think part of it is also being a little bit gentle with oneself. If you recognize that there's something a little bit ugly there, something, you know, not that you don't necessarily want to cultivate, think it's important to not berate yourself constantly. I mean, I know people like this who are jealous and they let that jealousy kind of feed their own self-loathing. They call themselves bad people, or they don't even acknowledge the jealousy because it's so ingrained at that point, and they don't try to move beyond it because they're ashamed. It's something that is not considered dignified. And so I think if I were to go back and meet myself at that point in my early 20s, I would say, you know, this is not your finest moment. These are not your finest moments when you are dying of jealousy over these friends of yours who are doing so well in their careers, but let yourself feel it so that you can move on, because just basking in it isn't helping either.
So allow it to be instead of pushing it away.
Yeah, and I feel that way a lot about various kinds of suffering too. Mm-hmm. In the last couple of years, having been really physically ill, suffering has been something that I've been very interested in and have tried to read a lot about, different avenues of looking at suffering and how to endure suffering or get through suffering. And some of it is just, you know, feel it and try to get through the next 5 seconds, the next 10 seconds. Don't think to yourself, I need to get through a whole lifetime of physical suffering. Yeah, I think it all fits together.
Another piece of that too is we tend to feel the most shame around our most human parts of ourselves. We're all people. We all go through the same things in different ways. And yet somehow that shared humanity is often what causes us the most shame. Like we want to rise above who we are and feel like we're not supposed to be humans, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think another hot tip now that I'm thinking about it is to just have really good friends, because there have been times when, you know, for example, when my first book wasn't selling, didn't sell for over 2 years. It was a really hard time. I would get so upset every time I went to a bookstore. It was just so painful for me because I would scan the shelves and go, okay, that publisher rejected me, and also that publisher rejected me, and this person's book got published, and I know their writing isn't as good as mine. I would just go down this spiral, and then I would talk to one of my dearest friends about it, and I would say, oh, I hate this about me. Why is this what I'm doing? And it was just really helpful to have this friend say to me, you're having a totally normal and human response to something that's hard for you. And yes, that helped a lot.
I love that. We have to be reminded of that. This is normal, what you're going through. And like my husband will say, give yourself a pass. Like, just let it be okay. Actually, you just talked about that with having your book. You know, it was over 2 years. And I read an interview that you did with Book Slut, and you shared, when my first book ran out and then kept coming back to me and kept coming back to me, it was crushing to me. I look back and I could still feel how upset the disappointments made me. And when I read that, I just thought, so how do you do that? You had, first of all, just to give a little context, you were a student at Yale, you were a student at Stanford, and then you got an MFA from University of Michigan, correct?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you were surrounded by very ambitious, accomplished people who often received book contracts very early on, like had a lot of success early on. So not only were you dealing with all this rejection from these different publishing houses, but you also had people in your inner circle who were succeeding at a fairly rapid rate. Mm-hmm. So how did you work with that? How did you keep submitting your work and resubmitting it in the face of that?
Yeah, so yes, to add a little bit even more context to that, by the time I sent my book out, I had not had a single friend who had not gotten a six-figure deal on their debut novel, which is incredibly, now I know that's incredibly rare, but at the time I thought it was normal. And so by the time I was getting rejected over and over again, I thought there was something incredibly wrong with me to not have had my book picked up within 48 hours or to not have had my book go to auction within a week. And the only honestly, the only thing I can say that kept me going is also, I think, the main thing that's kept me going through illness, which is I'm incredibly stubborn. There's something in me, and I think stubbornness is one of the best qualities a person can have when it comes to getting through hard times, whether that hard time is having your book rejected over and over again by big publishers for years, or, you know, being very sick and pretty much unable to get out of bed for months or years at a time, and being in incredible physical pain and illness. I think all of getting through all of that has been difficult, but it was my stubbornness that really got me through.
It's your stubbornness, but underneath that, or with that, is this faith. Because we either have doubt or we have faith, and sometimes, and a lot of times, we just live in both worlds. But there's this faith throughout it all that it's going to work somehow.
Yeah. I think it's, okay, I would say it's add one part stubbornness, one part faith, and one part hope.
Okay, so for someone who says, okay, I want to do this thing and it's not happening right away, to go, maybe I need a little more stubbornness or a little more faith or a little more hope, but I need some part of all three, or all three, or two of the three.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it's worked for me. I can't really say for other people, but I think it's a fascinating question. How do people keep going? That was also something that I kept encountering when I was researching suffering. The Viktor Frankl book, Man's Search for Meaning. His whole thing is that as long as we feel we have a purpose, or our life is fitting into the story with a purpose, we can keep going. And so I think that also fits in with the whole idea of faith and hope and stubbornness too.
And that's a great book to bring up, because one of the things that he says is it's not so much about what you want from life, but what life wants from you. And as it relates to you, Esme, it's like life wants you to write, because you have to write. You keep writing. And so that's part of it, is you're just answering that, whether you feel like you have no choice or you have a choice, you're answering what life wants from you.
Yeah, I do feel that way to a large degree. And you know, maybe that will change. Maybe someday I'll become so sick that my cognition will completely go down and I won't be able to write anymore. Or, you know, something might happen and I might not be capable of being a writer anymore, but I'll get there when I get there. And in the meantime, this is what I am.
So looking at this idea of this is what you are right now, and you may come to that place in your life where you can't write anymore. And we all live with that uncertainty, whether we feel the immediacy of it or not. We all live with that. But this brings me to a part that I wanted to get into with you, which is this idea of identity and sense of who we are. And there's a book, Wired to Create, which was written by two people, Scott Kaufman and Carolyn Grigore. And they say in it that the artist's observations become a means of answering the fundamental question, what does it mean to be a human being? Mm-hmm. I loved that. And I'm wondering how your experience with mental illness, with physical illness, with everything has informed your approach to this question of what it means to be a human being.
Some of the things that inspire me most in writing, or that push me forward in writing, is wanting to convey certain experiences that I haven't seen in literature already, or that I haven't seen in a way that resonates with me. So, for example, something that really pushed me forward with The Border of Paradise, which is my first novel, was wanting to portray what certain kinds of mental illness are really like in my experience. So there is one section of the book where one of the main characters, David Nowak, is walking in the woods and he has a hallucination. And I hope that that depiction of what it's like to experience a hallucination, I hope that someone out there reads it or has read it and thinks to themselves, like, wow, I've never seen a portrayal like this before. you know, in so many other things I've read that are about psychosis or mental illness or hallucinations or visions or whatnot, there's very much this, oh, I had a hallucination and then it wasn't there anymore, or I saw something and then it disappeared and I knew that it wasn't real. And I really wanted to dive very deeply into what it's actually like to experience a hallucination. And so that section is actually, I don't know, maybe like a page and a half long or something. But I do have a really strong drive to wanting to portray what it's like to be a certain kind of human. And those things about me, you know, being the child of immigrants, being Taiwanese American, having a disability, things like that, that aren't necessarily portrayed very much in literature or in the world. I want to be the person or one of the people to bring that to the page.
I want to ask you something about that. Before I do, I just want to say that one of the things that I find so moving about your honesty around your mental illness, your physical illness, where what I find so moving about it is that you, in writing so honestly about it, you give people the space to have the conversation. Without that honesty, there's this kind of awkwardness. Like, do I ask? Can I ask this? Or what is this? Can we go there? But when somebody just says, hey, here's the truth, here's my truth of it, it then says, it's all okay. I can talk about this. I can have this conversation because Esme's given me the permission to have it.
I mean, I hope so. That would be great. I hope that is the case.
Well, it certainly has been my experience. And then I would just say, I'm curious. One of the big questions that often comes up when people are creating something, especially with writing, but it can be any form of creativity, is I've just crossed the line. Like, this is too much to share, or I don't think I can say this because it might hurt somebody else, or I don't know how my parents will feel. So where has that struggle shown up for you around your personal story? Because you seem to share very openly and honestly about what you are going through and what you've been through.
Okay. So yeah, this is an interesting question that comes up a lot. There are things that I don't write about, and I probably, well, it's hard to say never, but I may never write about them. Things having to do with my marriage particularly, or with my relationship with my husband, I feel like are off limits for me. I feel like that is so much about his life as well. And it's not just my realm. So I've decided to not really write about my marriage much. He'll show up sometimes in an essay, but I don't write about that. So there are things that are off limits for me that I've put as off limits to myself. Because I don't want to expose certain things, or I don't want to hurt people. I have had a friend who had a book come out a number of years ago. It was the lead title for a big five publishing house, and it was very autobiographical. It was a novel, but it was extremely autobiographical about her experience and her family's experience in a very conservative sect of a certain religion. And I watched her go through the publication of that with a lot of pain. There were many times when she told me she wished she, you know, had just like written a novel or made things up, because that ended up becoming incredibly painful for her. And the community she grew up in didn't like the book. There, she had problems with her family. And so I've seen close at hand how painful that can be. I'm not the kind of person who's going to say, you should always write what you feel you want to write, even if it hurts other people, because it's your right. Okay, never mind. So to rewind, you can do that, of course. Like, go ahead. But there is also the chance that you will alienate people. And, you know, as all actions have consequences, even creative ones.
I've thought about this a lot in writing, and I remember coming to a point, because people would encourage, they said, you write, you have to be honest, you have to put it out there, and this is your story, and that's what writing's about. And then at some point I just felt like it's very important to be honest in one's writing, and there's also a respect for other people in your life, for their own paths. Like, They may have screwed something up in my eyes, but I don't know what their story is. I don't know what path they had to walk to get to where they are. And there almost seem like an unfairness in just presenting this one piece of it. So I think that there's something about being able to really share your story and knowing that the person that or people that you're writing about also are people with hearts and souls and pains and just being conscious of that as you write.
Yeah, in The Situation and the Story by Vivian Gornick, Gornick writes about having compassion for each person in your story if you're writing something that's true to life. And it's something that I'm really wrestling with this one essay in particular that's going to be in my forthcoming book about somebody in my life who raped me and went on to, you know, become sex offender, like a registered sex offender for other felonies and things. And this piece, I'm very aware, could bring some upset in my life. It's very scary to me for a lot of reasons. And one of those reasons is I don't want to be unfair. There's just giving the surface skim of it just now, you know, it sounds like this person is really terrible. And maybe he is in a lot of ways. But I also know that this person is in a relationship now. And maybe this person will end up having kids later. And I don't know what's going on with him now. So I do think it's important to kind of interrogate oneself about the work that you're putting out there as a writer or as any kind of artist.
Yeah. And as you're sharing, I can see that, oh yeah, it's this constantly evolving process because you're going through it right now. And I imagine you're going to keep asking yourself these questions as you go deeper into the essay and as you move forward with other essays, that it will keep coming up.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Another piece of that is in the writing. You have a very clear voice. You know, I know that you went to school and you got an MFA, so you studied a lot about writing and communicating who you are through writing. What are some kind of fundamental pieces to how we, and I don't like to actually say find your creative voice, because your creative voice is, it's there. It's in us all the time. So, but how we come back to it, how we unearth it.
So I actually wrote a blog post about finding your writing voice. And I feel like kind of calling back to that right now, because the analogy that I feel best fits this question of how do I find my voice in any kind of art. To me, it's like finding your handwriting. I feel like once we reach a certain age, our handwriting is kind of just what it is. You know, I rarely meet somebody who's, you know, in their 30s or 40s or above who just suddenly dramatically decides to change their handwriting. But the question is, like, how did you get to the handwriting you currently have? Like, I remember very clearly, I think maybe in like fourth grade, I noticed that my friend Sharon's handwriting was really thin and tall, and mine was not. And I remember consciously deciding, I'm going to try to make my handwriting a little bit thinner and taller. And then, you know, since then, it's evolved. So it's gotten like spikier. It's gotten smaller. There are things that have changed. My handwriting hasn't really dramatically changed in a while now. And I think that's because I've settled into my handwriting. But along the way, it has changed quite a bit. And I didn't know what my quote unquote like life handwriting was going to be, but it was a journey. It took a while.
It's an interesting analogy because I think you're right. We do that as little kids. We'll look to other people's handwriting and say, oh, I like that about that. I'm going to try to do that. And the other piece of that is sometimes when I write things, I go, oh, that's how my hand is writing it right now. Like, I'm surprised by the handwriting, and mm-hmm. I don't know if it's going to come out a certain way. And then there'll be other times when it comes out smaller or it comes out bigger. So that's just fascinating to look at that. Like, it's the same. You can compare that to the creative voice. It's like, we don't always know how it's going to sound. It's that process of discovery.
Yeah. And you also, or very frequently, a writer will have different voices for different situations. So my essayistic voice is a little bit different than my novelistic voice, or, you know, depending on the essay, the voice might be a little bit different, even though it's like basically the same. Your handwriting might be kind of faster and looser when you're taking notes versus when you're writing a thank you letter versus when you're filling out forms. There's probably something fundamentally similar about those things. But yeah, different things for different handwritings and different voices for different occasions, I think.
And just to put a cap on that, it's also that permission to show up in all these different ways. Like, we don't have to have this thing figured out. We don't have to know, this is Daphne, this is Esme, that, oh, when Esme is writing a thank you card, it might look like this. And when she's taking notes, it might look like this. Like, there's all these different facets. And to just, there's space for all of that. So in finishing up, a few things. So first, one thing I do at the end of the interview, and then I have a last question. But before that, if you can just let people know where to learn more about your fiction, your nonfiction, your work that you're putting out into the world.
Okay. Well, to find out basically everything there is to know about me on the internet, almost, you can go to esmewang.com. So that's esmewang.com. And from there, you can find my newsletter with Love and Squalor, as well as the resources that I mentioned previously, as well as information and links to my writing, including information about my book. Yeah, so there's that. And I'm also very active on Twitter. And so that's at Esme Wang. And on Instagram, which is at Esme W. Wang.
Great. I will finish with one comment and then one last question. And so what I like to do at the end of the interview is a little bit of appreciation. But for you, what I'd like to appreciate, I've always been, in following you, really moved by your sensitivity and your sensibility and just the way that you carry yourself through life. It's like, I find that when I listen to you, a part of me just quiets down, like calms down. And it's like the aesthetic sense that you have, the way that you see, want a lot of beauty in your life and see beauty, you really bring that into the world. And I wanted to acknowledge you for that.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And then the last question is, I believe that everyone's creative and everyone is an artist. Everyone has something to make. So as a writer, as someone who writes and makes for a living, why do you think it's important that people make their thing, whatever it is, no matter their fears and doubts?
I think it's important because everybody has their own story, and whether that's your life story or something fictional, whether it's an aesthetic sense, and that there's a story in that too, whether it's stories you've heard, everybody has some kind of story to tell. And actually, I believe everybody has many stories. Because you have that, or you have those rather, it's really wonderful to be able to share that with other people. And I think it's something that brings beauty into the world. It brings people closer together. It's a way to express oneself, if that's a thing that you care about. And art is really important, I think. So yeah, I don't know if that was the most
eloquent
statement, but yeah, I do feel strongly about that.
Thanks, Esme.
Thank you so much.